This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Public schools cannot use race as a factor to achieve racial diversity. That's what the Supreme Court said today in one of the most anticipated decisions of this term. The ruling involves slightly different cases from Seattle, Washington and Louisville, Kentucky. School districts in both cities use voluntary racial guidelines to maintain integration. A noble goal, the court said today, but a violation of individual rights. Many school districts around the country use similar policies, and critics worried that today's decision will accelerate re-segregation. The Supreme Court decision is our main focus this hour. Later in the program, we'll remember the woman who redesigned women's clothes for the workplace. Liz Claiborne died yesterday. But first, race in schools. If you have questions about today's ruling or how it might affect your school, give us a call. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. He's with us here in Studio 3A. David, nice to have you on the program as always.
Hi, Neil.
More than 50 years ago, the court ruled that laws that segregated schools were unconstitutional in Brown versus Board of Education. Desegregation was deemed so important that federal courts supervised dozens of busing plans around the country, many of them highly controversial. How does today's decision fit in that context?
Well, after a lot of those busing plans ended, many school districts, particularly in the big cities, tried to come up with voluntary guidelines or some sort of voluntary programs that would continue some sort of integration. Some school districts use racial guidelines for all their schools, which Louisville did, and some use them just for certain schools. For example, you might have a magnet school, and you might say, you can't have more than 70% of any one race at this school, because the whole purpose of the magnet school, or one of the purposes, was to maintain integration. And the school, Supreme Court basically said today that you can't have explicit racial guidelines for assigning students. If you have the 70% guideline and a white child says, I want to go to that school, and the school board says, sorry, you're going to have too many white students in that school or too many black students, you can't go to that school because of your race. What the court said today by a 5-4 vote is that's unconstitutional.
Yet in school districts around the country, since the end of those busing programs, resegregation has happened almost across the board.
Well, yes, that's right. It's just a product of segregated housing, in a whole lot of cities. I don't know, the south part of the town may have a large concentration of African Americans. The north part of the town has a larger group of whites. So those schools in those areas are segregated. And the court's decision today makes it hard, but I'd say not impossible, for school boards to achieve some integration. They left open the possibility that schools could adopt some. This is Justice Kennedy speaking for himself, said that you could have a voluntary integration program that, for example, was voluntary on the students' part. What if you said that minority students from the inner city schools can voluntarily transfer, be bused to a suburban school that's white? That would be okay because there's no sort of cutoff or no exclusionary rule there. It would be truly voluntary on the students' part.
Justice Kennedy said that could be a factor, but that he thought these cases, Seattle and Louisville, both went too far. And he is really the key vote in this case.
Yes, absolutely. It's his opinion that all the school board lawyers will be reading now and trying to figure out what they can and cannot do, because he goes along with the majority in saying these programs have what he called crude racial guidelines. You can't have that. But he went on to talk about how integration is a good thing and that school boards can pursue policies that try to integrate the schools.
And interestingly, it ended up that both sides ended up citing Brown versus Board of Education in an attempt to support their side.
Yes, that's right. John Roberts delivered the opinion, and he quoted the Brown decision as saying, we want to get to a time when race does not decide who goes to what school, that we want to move to a non-racial system of assigning students. And he said, that's what we're saying is the law today.
Mm-hmm. And the minority?
The dissenter said, you're going back on the promise of Brown, because Brown was really about trying to bring about an integrated school system, an integrated society, and you're basically telling school boards they can't set racial integration guidelines for each school.
Now, what happens as a result of this decision? Obviously, this impacts directly on the cities of Louisville and Seattle. What about the rest of the country?
Well, I would think that the rest of the country's school board lawyers are going to say, we can't have explicit racial guidelines for assigning students to any of our schools. If we have a guideline that says, you know, there's a limit, we can't do that. If we're going to have a racial integration policy, we need to find some other way to do it. So I don't think... It is not true that all school boards around the country have these policies, but many of them do. And I think in Los Angeles, for example, there are some magnet schools that have these kind of guidelines, and I think this casts doubt on them. I'm not sure the courts will strike down all those decisions because of the uncertainty of how to read Kennedy's opinion.
We're going to hear from the attorneys in the Seattle case, and we're going to talk with the lawyer for the school district in just a few minutes. But joining us now is Harry Correll. He's with us from his office in Seattle. He represented the parents in the Seattle case and argued on their behalf before the Supreme Court. It's nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The court agreed with your argument that schools cannot use racial guidelines to achieve integration. Tell us, what was the genesis of this suit?
The suit came about because the Seattle plan wasn't, in our view, designed to achieve integration, but rather to accomplish a predetermined racial balance. And the result was that a number of students, minority students around Franklin High School and white students around Ballard and two other high schools, were not allowed entrance into their preferred and neighborhood schools. In our view, the school district's plan was turning Brown on its head and making specific admissions decisions based solely on skin color. And that seems to us unconstitutional.
You understand the other side cites Brown versus Board of Education as well.
They do. And I think the other side's view is, there's always some risk at characterizing your opponent. I think the other side's view is that Brown, the message of Brown was one of ends, not of means. That is, the end was supposed to be this mandated racial balance in schools. The other reading of Brown is that the government needs to be colorblind, or at least can't make decisions based on students' skin color. And I think in that respect, I mean, both sides are fighting over the legacy of Brown.
Fighting over the legacy of Brown. And in a way, you were saying that the individual rights of these students trumps the broader goal, noble as it might be, of integration.
I think that's right. And again, I'm leery of your using the term integration, because that integration is fixing segregation, right? And In Seattle, I mean, the whitest school in the district at which this plan applied was over 35% non-white. It also applied at Roosevelt High School, which was 45% non-white. It defies logic to say that those schools are segregated and in need of integration. What was going on was a desire to have a particular racial balance. Good motive or not, that, I think, offends the Constitution.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Just to remind you, our guests are David Savage, the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and with us by phone is Harry Correll, who's an attorney for the parents involved with community schools. He was on their side and argued their case before the Supreme Court. And let's see if we can get Jam on the line. Jam is with us from Wilmington. Is that Wilmington, Delaware?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead, please.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask about the historic context of this. I didn't read the whole decision, obviously, but I thought I read a quote by Clarence Thomas in a decision or concurrence that talked about how the Constitution needs to treat all the citizens equally. And if my history is right, isn't the Constitution the document that says African Americans should be treated as three-fifths of people? And I thought we had the system that we had, and the Brown decision and all these attempts to equal everything out, to make up for that historic imbalance. So I guess I'd ask for a comment on that and how today's ruling might affect that kind of decision and what we're trying to do.
Harry Correll?
Sure. I mean, the caller raises an important question, and the history of our government's treatment of racial issues in our country is an ugly one in the past. But the hope was that the 14th Amendment fixed that. The it was applied in the Brown decision. But if you read the 14th Amendment and you read the Brown decision, it doesn't say that the government can't make decisions based on race unless there's a good reason, or if the students are white, the rule is one way. I mean, an important observation in the Justice Kennedy opinion, he points out, this is at, I think it's page 15, says reduction of an individual to an assigned racial identity for differential treatment is among the most pernicious actions our government can undertake. That is the heart of Brown, which is that government, one of the most offensive things government can do is look at you, decide about you based on your race. That's what we were fighting against in this case. We were fighting for the application of the language and meaning of Brown to students in Seattle. And to be clear, again, it's not just white students who were affected by this policy. It's minority students, too, and the parents group is not just white parents. It's minority parents as well.
And David Savage, let me follow up by saying Brown versus Board of Education said that segregated school systems, segregated by law, were unconstitutional. These are voluntary systems.
Well, they're enforced by the school board's policy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the court was, if it was truly voluntary in the sense that students could choose to go or not go, then that would be voluntary on the students' part. This was a school board policy that sort of was a legal rule. So that's why the Harry Correll could attack it, because that school board policy, that school board rule said, sorry, no more white kids or no more African-American kids at that school.
Mm. Jam, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for having me.
And Harry Correll, congratulations. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Happy to help.
Harry Correll, an attorney for the parents involved with community schools. He presented oral arguments on their behalf before the Supreme Court, and his position prevailed. When we come back, we're going to be talking with the lawyer for the Seattle School District, whose position was not upheld earlier today. Also, David Savage will still be here with us. If you have questions about today's decision and its meaning, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we remember the woman who dressed a generation of working women. Liz Claiborne died yesterday. Right now, we're talking about the Supreme Court's decision on race in schools and how it might change the way public schools decide who goes where. Today's decision came in a 5-4 vote. The majority rejected school diversity plans that take into account a student's race. The case involved two school districts in Seattle, Washington, and Louisville, Kentucky. Plenty of other districts around the country would be forced to reconsider their own policies, too. David Savage is with us. He's Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Just if you have questions about today's ruling or how it might affect your school, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Just a few minutes ago, we spoke with the attorney for parents involved with community schools. Joining us now from Seattle is attorney Michael Madden. He represented the Seattle School District before the Supreme Court, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Good afternoon.
And you must be somewhat disappointed by today's decision.
Well, disappointed to a certain extent, but not completely. As you know, the court, by a 5-4 majority, did uphold the ability of schools to consider race in assigning students, and unfortunately was not able to produce a majority with any clarity as to how you can do that.
Mm-hmm. So you take comfort in Justice Kennedy's suggestion that race could still be a factor under certain circumstances.
Well, I think Justice Kennedy, in fact, goes further than that. He quite clearly says that there is a compelling interest in achieving integration in the schools, even when the condition that you're trying to address is not the product of past purposeful segregation, and then goes on to describe a two-tiered approach whereby one can have use means that are not overtly racial, such as drawing attendance zones or locating schools or program placement. And if those measures aren't sufficient, he goes on to say that one can, in a more targeted way than he felt was done in Seattle and Louisville, use measures that are overtly racial.
Yet you argued before the justices that the Seattle Racial Assignment Plan was not a quota system. Quote, the purpose was to have schools that had become diverse through integration efforts not stray too far from the community's demographic, because you said we're trying to prepare students to live in those communities. Are you worried that today's decision will force some changes on that?
Well, in Seattle, the issue is somewhat academic on that score, because the plan in question hadn't been used since 2001. But nationally, certainly people are going to have to put their heads down and consider what Justice Kennedy has said, evaluate that in light of the opinions by the other justices, because there clearly is going to be continued litigation risk for districts. But to look at what Justice Kennedy has said and carefully, and see what measures might be employed to try to achieve or preserve integration in the case of Seattle.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to, this is Matthew. Matthew with us from San Francisco.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, it's just essentially wrong to discriminate against kids on the basis of race. And the Seattle School District attorneys like to trot out that, you know, only 10% of kids were turned away, you know, based upon their plan back in 2001, and 90% got to the school of their choice. However, those 10% represent thousands of kids who were basically denied the opportunity to go to the school of their choice. I grew up in Seattle in the 70s, and I went to a very diverse middle school, and I was really glad that I was in that type of setting. But the minute that I asked to go to a high school on the north end of town, where they actually had a educational program that I was very interested in, my father had to be present our credentials, quote unquote, to the PTA board. It was promptly labeled a racist for having his white kid run up to the north end of town where all the white kids live and go to school already. And you know, this is what the case is about. This is what the ruling is about. It's about the kids and about getting a fair chance at an education that they desire. And it's not supposed to be based upon the color of the skin. That is just fundamentally wrong in America, even today.
Michael,
I very much support the ruling today.
Michael Madden?
Well, there are multiple parts to that question. You know, as the caller points out, Seattle has a long history of employing integration measures, and responding in part to what Harry Carell had said earlier, it was not always the case that Seattle schools were, you know, in general diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1970s, which is probably when the caller was in the Seattle school system, of course, the district was on its way to the Supreme Court the first time because of a state law that attempted to outlaw all busing for integration purposes. And yes, Seattle has had this issue, and I would never discount that people feel that they have been harmed when they don't get the school assignment of their choice, and particularly if that's when the result of a racial classification. You know, on the other hand, is Justice, and this may be where Justice Kennedy's coming from in saying, you know, it's not unconstitutional if you have a racial purpose, meaning to achieve integration, but you don't use an overtly racial means to get there, meaning how you draw, for instance, an attendance zone, or placing a particularly attractive program in a, say, a school that's in a predominantly minority neighborhood.
Which is a fairly common practice.
True.
Yeah. But what about Matthew's point that it's about the kids and their rights?
Well, it is about the kids and their rights, but the question is, you know, in the end of the day, do you avoid the situation that he describes of people feeling like, well, you're a racist if you want to go to a North End school? Do you avoid that if you have fully integrated schools where you don't feel that there's a great disparity in the quality of those schools based on their racial makeup?
Okay. Thanks for the call, Matthew.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get Paula on the line. And Paula's with us from Willow Grove, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the product of an interracial marriage, meaning I was raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia and went through a predominantly white school. I guess my concern is for my, you know, children that are growing up that are labeled black, how is this going to affect them having equal education, just like with the different programs? You know, in the suburbs, you have honor classes that you may not have in the city. You have art classes and music and just things that many of the inner city schools don't always offer. How, I agree with the decision, but I'm concerned on how it's going to affect the future generations of minority children.
Michael Madden, you want to take a shot at that?
I think it's unfortunately too early to tell. I mean, the scope of what Justice Kennedy would allow, if his is indeed the controlling view here, needs more than 4 hours study. He clearly thinks, and really the breadth of difference between the four members of the court who signed Chief Justice Roberts' opinion and the Kennedy opinion is summed up by looking at the end of the two opinions, because clearly the Roberts group was willing to say that problems of racial disparity that are not the product of de jure action by the government are no business of the government.
De jure meaning a legal action of the government.
That's
by law.
That's right.
All right.
And Justice Kennedy, we're grateful for this, dramatically disagrees.
All right. Paula, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. And we'd like to thank Michael Madden for his time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Madden, attorney for the Seattle School District, who presented oral arguments on their behalf before the Supreme Court, which did not find in support of his case. David Savage, here's an email question from Tom in St. Louis, Missouri. Will the Supreme Court ruling affect public university admissions?
I think not. One of the surprises today, I'd say mild surprises, was that a lot of us were following this case thinking that this could be the first move of John Roberts and the more conservative court to overturn affirmative action in colleges and universities. And Roberts began his opinion by talking about the decision 4 years ago and saying that higher education is a unique circumstance, and colleges and universities can give great weight to diversity and consider a student's race in that context. So I took it that there's nothing in this opinion that would lead you to think that they're going to go back on where they were 4 years ago. 4 years ago, they said you can't have a sort of quota-like program that assigns all minority students certain points, but you can consider race as a sort of plus factor as long as you individually evaluate the students as part of an affirmative action program, and I think that's where we still are.
Let's get Jim on the line, and Jim's calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, I was wanting to ask our guest. I mean, you know, for the average middle-class American, which I happen to be a part of, the ruling matters absolutely nothing to us. I mean, what's it mean? I mean, you know, I'm still stuck in the same socioeconomic class that I'm stuck in. I cannot afford to move out of my school district to a better school district. I wish I could, but I can't. So, in essence, what's it mean to 80% of Americans who are middle class? I mean, the ruling means nothing to us. We are still stuck in the schools that we must improve. And those schools, whether racially balanced or not, are the schools that we're stuck with. You know, if I was a little wealthier, I would do what most of my friends do, and that is put my kids in a private school that's 95 to 100% white and be done with it. I mean, so what's the ruling mean to us?
David, what do you think?
Well, the caller's probably correct that the ruling doesn't mean too much for him and for a whole lot of people in most city school districts. If there's anything that'd be encouraging from the opinion, it would be Justice Kennedy talking about how it's important to have integrated schools, and that to some degree that would sort of call for voluntary arrangements that would allow parents to transfer their kids to, from their point of view, more desirable schools. Some cities have tried that. I don't know whether Charlotte has tried it in after the busing
Most
program.
Certainly, we have a school choice plan. It doesn't matter. I mean, I can take my kid to any school in Charlotte, but the fact is I still have to provide transportation, which, do I want to drive an hour to South Charlotte? Probably not.
I see. So you have a school choice plan, but the parents have to provide the transportation.
If it's out of their school choice zone, yes.
I see.
Hmm.
and you usually have about 3 to 4 schools. But thank you for taking my call.
All right. Certainly. But extending on his point, there are critics of this decision who will say this will just accelerate, encourage people like him to move from presumably a mixed area to a less mixed area, to, in fact, encourage resegregation.
Yes, although, Neil, you remember that was the criticism of the busing programs all through the 70s, that the mandatory efforts to desegregate the schools encouraged one way or another a lot of white parents to leave the city entirely, and so they seemed in some ways the backlash made segregation worse. So that's an old problem.
David Savage of the Los Angeles Times. We're talking about today's Supreme Court decision on schools and race. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And David, actually, I wanted to ask you about another decision that the court issued today. We've heard a lot about the court's value of precedent in the past and how difficult it is to overturn precedent and how important precedent is. And today, a precedent of 96 years standing thrown out by the Supreme Court.
Yes, they overturned a very old one. It's called the Dr. Miles Rule. You'd have to be an expert in antitrust law to know it. But if you're a consumer, you're familiar with it. If you look at a new car and it says manufacturer's suggested retail price. The reason it says suggested is that manufacturers are not allowed to fix or set a retail price. Independent retailers are entitled to discount. And manufacturers can't by contract enforce fixed prices. The court threw out that rule today and said we're going to allow manufacturers to basically market their products and set the prices they choose. And I think this will actually show up. A lot of consumers will see this for different products. Certainly not all manufacturers will deal it, but some will. They would want to say, we want to have full-service retailers with showrooms, displays, mm-hmm. and we're going to set a higher price and forbid discounters. And so I think people who like to buy on the Internet or whatever may find themselves, at least in the future, with some products that they can't get them at a discount.
Now, why isn't that an antitrust problem?
Well, the court's view is that competition is really between brands, not within the brand. If you don't like a watch that's got a certain high price, basically buy another watch. I mean, that's the logic. And that the logic of it is this is a 5-4 decision, that there's competition between manufacturers and between brands, but we're going to allow the manufacturer to sort of market his product the way he chooses, and if that means setting a fixed price of $400 or $20 for that item, they may do so.
And they can enforce it. But this would that still hold if you manufactured the product that absolutely dominated your market?
No. If you're Microsoft and you dominate the market, then that would be anti-competitive because the consumer wouldn't have any real choices. But for most consumer products, golf clubs, tennis rackets, watches, little computer gizmos, there are plenty of, and they're saying now on, manufacturers may choose to set fixed prices.
A price floor.
A price floor, that's correct.
And interesting, 5-4. John Roberts came when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said he would be working more and more towards getting the court towards consensus, towards getting away from these 5-4 decisions, which are often not definitive.
It's certainly the case that this term ended on a series of very bitterly divided 5-4 decisions. The four liberal justices sort of voted in a block. And so, at least to that extent, Roberts has not brought about harmony and unanimity.
Also, that today's decision on these price floors, one of several decisions in this term that seem to be coming down in favor of corporate interest.
Yes, I think I counted 15 this term that made it harder to either sue businesses or harder to win damages from business. It was a very good term for businesses and corporations.
And we can take from that what?
Well, some of those decisions had a fairly big block of justices. They really are skeptical of antitrust laws. They're skeptical of business regulation. They're skeptical of big lawsuits. But it's also Sam Alito, on some of the really close cases, is a more conservative person than Sandra O'Connor and created a 5-member majority for some of these pro-business decisions.
So you get to take the rest of the summer off, David?
No.
No.
Actually not.
Oh, that's a bummer. David Savage covers the Supreme Court and, I guess, other issues at the Department of Justice for the Los Angeles Times.
True.
You know, this Gonzales thing, they may keep you here all summer, David.
I fear that, Neil.
We'll be talking to him when he does. David Savage of the Los Angeles Times with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Coming up, she put the power in power suits. Liz Claiborne died yesterday, but her shoulder pads live forever. If you are wearing Liz to your first board meeting, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.